Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Here in the second hour of the program, we'll spend the first half of it with Dr. Bob Weiss talking about loss and mourning at the beginning of life. We'll start out with a little story that he has to tell. He has some pastoral experience with this subject. In about 25 minutes, we'll be listening to what Jennifer Trafton has to say. She's from Christian History and Biography Magazine. We'll be talking about St. Benedict, and then Audio Open Lines is the entire last hour of the program. We've got a subject that I think will probably take an hour to discuss. If not, we got other things to share with you during Audio Open Lines. ABC News Nightline did a feature titled Searching for a Manly Jesus. We've had this conversation with Paul Coughlin many times, and it appears Paul Coughlin is involved in a movement, a lay movement, trying to restore the machismo to Jesus. That's a simplification, but it's perhaps a good example of diagnosing the symptoms correctly, but because they're not really getting to the root of the problem, their treatment is less than adequate. All it does is deal with the symptoms. We'll talk about that in the last hour of the program. Dr. Bob Weiss joins us here in Studio A. He's professor of practical theology at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. He holds the Lutheran Foundation of St. Louis Chair of Pastoral Ministry and Life Sciences at Concordia Seminary. And he's author of an article in the latest issue of Mercy Works magazine titled Loss at the Beginning of Life, Grief and God's Grace. Bob, welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Before you were doctor and seminary professor, you served as a pastor. And you have some pastoral experience with grief and loss at the beginning of life. Tell us your story.
Well, this, of course, actually began on Vicarage in St. Mark's Lutheran Church in Steelville, Illinois, where it was the first time I encountered the death of a wished-for baby. A baby, in fact, these were twins that died within the mother's womb at about 15 weeks. And not knowing much about, I knew about this from having been a professor in medicine a little bit, but not knowing much from a pastoral view, well, how can you share God's love in a situation where people tend to shake their fist and want to know why? The same questions that happen in a lot of tragic circumstances where people die unexpectedly. I went to listen to a group of nuns at St. Elizabeth Hospital in Belleville, Illinois, back in 1980. And at that time, and it still is, it was called SHARE, a Pregnancy and Infant Loss Support System, that was begun at St. John's Hospital in Springfield, Illinois. And from that point on, I started to gather information from this organization called SHARE, which is now housed out on New Ballas Road. And they have all kinds of information to help couples deal with the death of a wished-for baby or any infant that dies after they're born, regardless of the cause. And having been in the parish 10 years, and then I took a call to Concordian Seminary in 1992, and about 10 years later, my oldest daughter, Andrea, who is a family practice physician, also does some obstetrics. Her and her husband became pregnant, and they announced the pregnancy at our home on Mother's Day and said, oh, you might want to add another room, you know, where the family's growing. Mm-hmm. And so we were all excited, another baby coming. They already had one daughter. We had one granddaughter and through them, and blessed that way. And then about 19 weeks later, she called up, and she was practicing medicine up in Wisconsin, her and her husband, and said, you know, we have some bad news. The baby died inside the womb at about 19 weeks. And that just, well, that just knocks you back off, you know, knocks you to the wall. You know, you deal with this as a parish pastor, and then in this article, although it's not directly, but it is implied, you know, it says, I never thought that this would happen to my family. You know, it's typical questions that come up to anybody. Just because you're a pastor, you're not immune to this. So we immediately, Jan and I and the rest of the family, got up to Waupun, Wisconsin. And we got up there in time. They had to deliver the baby. She had to wait actually a couple of weeks. You know, things have to be done right. They have to induce delivery, and the baby was born dead. He was named Nathaniel John, and, you know, there's a lot of crying, a lot of tears. The local pastor there at Pella Lutheran Church, we did a memorial service at the hospital and then transported Nathaniel's body down to southern Illinois, to Royalton. I can't think of the name right now. At any rate, and we buried him there a few days later. And I did the graveside committal, and so he's been buried. And so And, of course, we did not have a baptism because he was born dead, but yet we leave him in the hands of our Lord. So from that point on, I've always told this story to my classes in bioethics and how, you know, as parish pastors you have to deal with this, but then when it happens to you, the gospel is the same. You still go to the cross not to deal with your suffering, but you find hope in your suffering, and that's what we've all done and we still do. And that's a story that basically is expanded here in this article.
Well, you know, this is my wife and I have had a similar experience between our two children. There was another, and it was not 19 weeks, but it was some weeks. And it strikes me both as someone who's been through it, but also as someone who served as a parish pastor with similar kind of experiences dealing with people who are going through this. That this is one of those things people don't often talk about. And it's not they don't talk about it because they don't consider it significant. They just don't talk about it because it's hard to struggle with this, much less try and explain what happened. Why is it that miscarriage is still something that people whisper about, even in the church where we can welcome one another and comfort one another? As no other place can.
Yes, we do that openly when somebody dies that we've known, or if there's a tragedy in the church, we talk about it a bit. But even, I think, in this case, I really think people don't know what to say. They want to say something, but they're kind of wondering, at least what we experienced and what I've experienced as a parish pastor, is they don't know what to say. And so if you're not knowing what to say, and you're fearful of saying the wrong thing, whatever that might be, but anything is of course, fine. You know, how you doing? And a hug, you don't have to say anything, is fine. But I think there is this situation of, we ran into this, you'd see people in the grocery store and they'd kind of wave at you, but they'd go the other direction. I think they know that they're looking at, here was a child, Nathaniel, that had a whole future in front of him, and now, you know, you sort of, what do you say? You know, there is no future now, other than you leave him in the hands of the Lord. And so I think that's kind of where I come from on this, is the issue of the silence is, don't know what to say.
So, you know, the Roman Catholic Church came up with, devised a system of comfort, so to speak, for its adherents when it's left with this situation of a child that dies apart from the benefit of being able to receive baptism. And they said, well, this is very simple. There's an intermediate state, limbo. I don't know how many people still believe it, but they still teach it. That's where the unbaptized children are. That is where perhaps the noble pagans are from long ago. But that is not a sufficient answer, nor is it a scriptural answer. What can we say, and what can't we say, according to Scripture, when life is cut short before birth, and especially before the opportunity for baptism?
I think what we can't say is to create, first of all, well, we know they're in heaven, don't worry about a thing, you were a Christian family, and hey, it's no big deal, you know, not a problem. We sort of trivialize this issue of resting in the hands or the bosom of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you know, the Lord resting in the bosom of Abraham. They're there, no problem. And so what we will do then is to quote the story of David and his firstborn who was lost the day before circumcision on the seventh day. And David says, well, you know, he can't come to me, but I'll go to him. And so people say, well, see, he's in heaven. And so that's where David says all babies are going to go because they haven't been baptized yet. And that's not what that article's talking about. So I don't think we need to trivialize the whole issue and to make light and to give false hope to couples and to say, look, hey, don't worry about a thing. Your Christian family, I can tell you for sure they're in heaven. This is God's disposition, not mine. So I think for certain we can say, you know, this is a creature of God. God created this child. And for whatever reason, God has allowed this child to die, and we leave this child within his grace, period. And
this is a child for whom Christ died,
yes,
no doubt about that.
Yeah, and he did. And so beyond that, I don't really get into any other Bible passages to quote, to leave the parents off to a sense of false hope, but to give them hope in their suffering.
So this is a really stark example of where the church has to say as much scripture as they can based upon scripture, but not say anymore.
Not say anymore. In other words, don't start to, as you do frequently here on AM 850, issues, etc., don't start pulling things out that aren't there or adding things to it that aren't there. In other words, stick to the bare bones, basically.
Does God offer any explanation? Because he is the master of life and death, and he is the one who numbers our days. That is quite clear. Does he offer any explanation for those whose days are numbered so short?
I have never found an explanation where I can open up to any Bible passage when Andrew and John lost Nathaniel and say, well, here's the answer why God allowed your son to die, and here it is right here. I don't know of any place in the Bible that we have it. In fact, I really often think that if we would know the reason, I'm not sure we can handle it, because he's very clear that his ways are not our ways and our mind's not our mind, his mind. But I don't also believe that he's up in heaven with a big G on his chest pushing buttons and saying, you're dead. He does tell us, though, in 1 Peter chapter 1, 3-9, though you suffer now for a little while, your faith more precious than gold redounds to the praise, honor, and glory of Jesus Christ. I mean, he talks about the relationship of suffering and faith a lot, and I think that's the most important issue.
The natural questions come up, and I'm sure they did in your situation too, and that is, look, we took all the prenatal vitamins, we did everything that the OBGYN said we ought to do, we were following the regime exactly, and in our big medical prevention society, that's supposed to ensure a favorable outcome and a healthy pregnancy. How do you respond to those things?
But yes, it should. But we can certainly get into the medical side here at AM 50 and talk about, well, you know, we did take a piece of skin from the inside to try and figure out if there was some sort of a genetic problem that was, we just didn't know. There was no evidence as to what caused his death. And you do take care of the child, you do this and you do that. But from what I tell people is stick to your vocation. If you're not a doctor, the doctors may be able to give you a cause of death if there's an autopsy, but then again, some it may not. But and that may help in terms of dealing with why the death happened. But then again, it still comes back to what you said. But we did all of this. Why did God allow this to happen? And then, of course, we're back to the question, I can't answer that one.
That's a question of God, and if God doesn't provide the answer, there's no answer that we can come up with either. We're talking about loss and grief at the beginning of life. Dr. Bob Weiss is our guest. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You can email your questions or comments. And on these kind of subjects, we're always happy to take your calls anonymously, if that's what you wish, or your email anonymously, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Let's go to Nashville, where Rick is waiting on the line. Hi, Rick.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi, Rick. Good afternoon.
I was wondering if Isaiah 57, the first couple of verses in that chapter, would apply to such a thing as we're talking about now. I've given it to people in the past, and I just wonder, would that be a right thing to say?
All right, Rick, thank you very much. The verses I think he's referring to, I read them. The righteous man perishes, and no one lays it to heart. Devout men are taken away while no one understands. For the righteous man is taken away from calamity. He enters into peace. They rest in their beds who walk in uprightness. This kind of goes back to the same question that we were talking about before. We cannot say on the basis of that passage that because children are not conceived in innocence.
No. Their body and soul, they are corrupted, and they are conceived in sin. And that, you know, that's a hard... a hard statement for some people, but within light of redemption, resurrection of Christ, it's not a hard statement. So I'm not sure I would apply the whole statement and say that this child was upright, and because of that, we know we can say for sure that they're resting with the Lord. We can say we leave them in the hands of the Lord in His good grace. Luther believed, from what I, now this is a sort of a distant recollection, but he did believe that when children of Christian parents die prior to or after birth, that they would rest in the hands of the Lord, because the parents' intentions obviously were to have this child baptized and raised in instruction and discipline of the Lord. But in that context, he never created any type of false hope. And I have found this to be something where we're struggling for an answer in the Bible. You know, here's something we can apply. I find that we need to stick to the scriptures as they are and not try and, again, read too much in or take too much out.
One thing someone might be tempted to do is say, well, I think I can sweep away all my concerns and maybe even my grief in this instance, that this was a pre-embryo, this was a pre-human, this was not fully a person, and therefore grief is not the appropriate response to a miscarriage. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think if this is a Christian that says that, then we would have to say that Christ was, his incarnation, went out with the baby in the bathwater because he clearly was conceived without sin, of course, and went through the same stage as we did. The Bible's very clear that he became like one of us in every way and all way. He was flesh and bones and blood and everything else, body and soul. So the use of any other term to, as they say, dehumanize what is in the womb has to fly into the face of God as creator. That's our credo. I believe that God has made me and all creatures and given me my body and soul. And this was done at, we would say, the moment of conception. So I don't believe that, these other terms that come popping out, pre-embryo, pre-zygote, these are terms that were developed by the scientific community so that we can experiment on them.
A couple weeks ago, we played a piece of audio during Audio Open Lines, Bob, that was from PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly, and it was just kind of a reporting feature on two couples. Both couples discovered through, I think, amniocentesis that both of their children had severe physical disabilities, whatever it may be. The one couple, highlighted here, opted for abortion, and the other couple opted to bring the child to term, and then they were interviewed in dealing with this child who's severely disabled, but they were and both claimed to be Christians. The one couple who had opted for abortion was very odd, almost eerie to hear the mother talking about having opted for abortion in this case, but mourning her child, believing that this was best for her child, that her child would understand all of this. She referred to this baby in her womb as a child, yet she opted for abortion and thought it was altogether appropriate to write the child letters, maybe explaining what she did and mourn in that sense. How do you respond to that? It seems that, I don't want to sound too harsh, but it seems a perverse response.
It's a very perverse response. To be quite frank, it's a cop-out. I mean, it's trying to, as usual, the sinful world to justify itself. When a Christian has been brought into the righteousness of God in Christ, you don't cause death, you don't kill, you serve other neighbors as yourself, you look at others as better than yourself, including the unborn. So when this occurs and they go through this genetic amniocentesis to determine whether or not this child should be kept or not, it's not the issue of whether it should be kept. The issue is whether and how you care for this child. And so to write these letters and everything is just simply the guilt of the sin that they have committed to abort this child is to try and, to me, it's a cover-up.
I hear people all the time try and draw a parallel, those who want to defend abortion. They'll draw a parallel between the number of elective abortions that are performed, say, in the United States, and how many miscarriages we can calculate statistically probably are occurring all the time. And they'll say, well, if God opposes abortion, why is he allowing all these miscarriages to take place? They draw a direct parallel between elective abortion and what we would call natural miscarriage.
Yeah, and there's no direct parallel. This is the old compare apples and oranges. I mean, you and your listeners know that somebody that goes in with the intent and the motive behind to cause death is not what goes on with a miscarriage. There is no intent to cause death. There is always intent to care for this child, and for whatever reasons this child is not carried full term or dies shortly before or thereafter, is not within the purview of a Christian to make the excuse that, well, you know, this is just like a miscarriage or this is just like an abortion. There is no similarity.
Real quick question before we wrap this up. You quote near the end of your article in the Mercy Works magazine, 2 Corinthians 12:9, famous passage from Paul where he talks about the words of the Lord to him, "My grace is sufficient for you, my power is made perfect in weakness." And we usually think of this in terms of physical weakness or emotional weakness, but could it also apply, say in the case of miscarriage, to the profound weakness of our understanding of these circumstances and how God could permit such things to occur?
Well, that's precisely why it's there, is that we just we collapse when these things happen. We are just we're on the ground. We are just lost and just feel limp. Not only limp physically, but spiritually. What has happened here, God? Why is this going on? And so this passage, from my viewpoint, my family's viewpoint, is to reemphasize His grace is sufficient, and it is made perfect in our weaknesses to deal with these issues. And so that's where we always find hope and comfort, in the grace of God.
Dr. Bob Weiss is professor of practical theology at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis, where he holds the Lutheran Foundation of St. Louis Chair of Pastoral Ministry and Life Sciences. He's author of an article in the latest issue of Mercy Works magazine titled "Loss at the Beginning of Life, Grief and God's Grace." Bob, it's always good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Speaking of mercy, this is, we lay not only the miscarried child, but also ourselves in the merciful hands of our Father, through our Lord Jesus Christ. Speaking of mercy, the LCMS Conference on Mercy is coming up this next month here in St. Louis at the Airport Marriott. It's going to be a gathering of some very significant speakers. We'll be broadcasting there live as well. Joining us will be Issues Etc. regular guests Larry Rast, Pastor Matt Harrison of LCMS World Relief, Beverly Yonke, Gene Edward Veith, Arthur Jest, Uwe Simonetto, and some others. For more information, look for the LCMS Conference on Mercy logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org. There's a link for more information. It's April the 30th through May the 2nd here in St. Louis, the LCMS Conference on Mercy. The website address again, issuesetc.org. And we hope to see you there. It's April the 30th through May the 2nd here in St. Louis. Well, when we come back from this break, we're going to talk a little history with Jennifer Trafton. She's managing editor of Christian History and Biography magazine. The theme of the latest issue, Christian History and Biography, is Benedict and the Rise of Western Monasticism. Sound a little obscure, however, after our conversation, I hope you will see that even an ancient figure like Benedict has long-lasting ramifications in the way he thought, what he taught, the practice that he established early in the church. And it continues to affect Christians today. We'll talk about it on the other side of this break. Then we'll have audio open lines for your questions and your comments. The question we're laying in front of you, is this the best way to deal with the lack of men in church? Develop a situation, an organization to man up Christianity. Get men together, have them listen to rousing stories, watch men bend socket wrenches. I think there's a guy who bends socket wrenches with his bare hands. Inspiring stories from fellow Christian men to inject a little masculinity back into the image of Jesus. We'll be playing an ABC News Nightline feature titled "Searching for a Manly Jesus," coming up in 30 minutes.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Christ Academy is a two-week residential program for high school-aged men on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Here's the director of Christ Academy, Brian Gurman.
The students at Christ Academy live in the dorms as a seminarian would. They study under the seminary professors, and they worship in Kramer Chapel. And it is literally taking the seminary experience and getting a good taste of it for those 2 weeks. And what they learn in the classroom, then they experience in Kramer Chapel, as that is really the center of the experience, just as it is throughout the academic year here on campus as well.
At Christ Academy, high school-aged men explore the possibility of someday becoming a pastor. Christ Academy takes place June the 17th through the 30th on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne. Look for the Christ Academy logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, 1-800-481-2155.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Terry Phillips, sitting in for Bob Dittmer. The president's signature education law, No Child Left Behind, is up for renewal, and several ideas are floating around Congress about changes. Some see minor tweaks as the answer, while others say the law needs to be overhauled completely. Steve Jordahl reports a vigorous but healthy debate is shaping up.
More than 50 members of the House and Senate are backing legislation that would allow states to opt out of No Child Left Behind. The state would have to pass a referendum, or two of three state authorities, the governor, the legislature, or the highest elected education official, could decide they want out. Dan Lipps of the Heritage Foundation says it gives states more control.
By shifting greater authority back to the local level, local leaders and state policymakers would be given back responsibility and the opportunity to improve our schools at the local level.
The administration acknowledges that some changes need to be made. It's willing to listen, but Department of Education spokesperson Holly Kuzmich says the focus still needs to be on student achievement and accountability.
But we think it's really important not to roll back the clock on accountability.
House Education Committee ranking member Buck McKeon supports the original law and will be fighting for the options the law gives to parents. His spokesperson, Lindsay Mask.
I can say that Mr. McKeon's focus is flexibility and choice.
Still, Gregory McGinty of the Broad Foundation says the debate is healthy.
Out of all of this, we want to get a strong consensus about, you know, fixing an education system that's a serious problem, and, you know, that our children in the end are losing out.
How the debate is resolved will set a course for the future of U.S. education. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
Several conservative Republicans, including South Carolina's Jim DeMint, are supporting the alternative bill. For Family News in Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
It's not too early to register now for summer programs at the St. Louis Zoo. The zoo offers education programs for all ages, including Camp Kangazoo, programs for youth, young children, adults, families, scouts, and more. Call 314-768-5408 to request a summer brochure or visit stlzoo.org/education for program information.
Issues Etc. is underwritten in part by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of our Book of the Month for March, Easter Is For Me. For more information, look for the Easter Is For Me cover on our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Easter Is For Me by Dandy Daly Mackle. It's a helpful resource to help teach young children about the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Easter Is For Me.
Those are Benedictine monks chanting, I believe it is, an offertory. Sounds very old, doesn't it? But in fact, it's a modern recording of these Benedictine monks. This is a group of men in this case who have, as part of their spiritual heritage, the teachings of a 5th century founder of Western monasticism, Benedict. We're going to be talking about Benedict during this half hour of Issues Etc. with Jennifer Trafton. She's managing editor of Christian History and Biography magazine. The theme of the latest issue of Christian History and Biography is Benedict and the Rise of Western Monasticism. Our call-in numbers, if you have a question or a comment, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You can also email your questions or comments right here to the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Jennifer, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks very much for having me.
I guess the natural question, kind of contemporary question, is that when Joseph Ratzinger took his new name, Benedict XVI, when he was elected pope recently, did he choose this Benedict as his namesake?
Well, he did say that he He chose it for several reasons. I don't know a whole lot about the reasons that he chose, but he looked back to two Benedicts. One of them is the Pope Benedict who guided the Church through the First World War, who was dedicated to peace. The other Benedict is the Benedict that we're talking about, someone who is called the father of Western monasticism, who had an enormous effect on the spread of Christianity through Europe, and he's also very much respected and revered in Germany, where the current pope was from. So he is looking back in part to this early 5th century Benedict, who is a kind of symbol of the Christian roots of European culture.
When we call Benedict the founder of Western monasticism, mm-hmm. most people might be a bit confused as to what that means. What was it that he gave birth to?
Yes, and that's a little bit of a misnomer, or it can cause some misconceptions. He didn't create the concept of monasticism. That had been going on for a long time, ever since the early church, for several centuries before Benedict. What Benedict did was he wrote a monastic rule, a blueprint for living the monastic life that ended up being the gold standard for Western monasticism. This is the rule that ended up really influencing most of the monasteries in medieval Europe for various reasons. It really took hold in later centuries. And so today we look back at Benedict not as a person who created monasticism, but the person who really symbolizes that most influential form of monasticism in Europe.
Some people might consider monasticism simply an artifact of history, something that no longer exists. It's a medieval thing.
Mm-hmm.
What is the influence of this Western form of monasticism originated by Benedict? Is it still around?
Still very much so. There are about 25,000 Benedictine monks and nuns in the world today, and thousands of others who are not specifically called Benedictines, but they live in accordance with the rule of Saint Benedict. And also today, there are a growing number of people, both Catholics and Protestants, who are associating themselves with monasteries in a more informal way, called oblates or monastic associates. And this is becoming a growing phenomenon. So this is still very much a kind of Christian lifestyle and spirituality that is going strong and attracting a lot of people.
Give us just a brief thumbnail sketch of what we know of the life of Benedict.
Well, we don't know a whole lot. What we do know comes from a 5th century pope named Gregory the Great, who wrote a life of Benedict as a way of showing a kind of ideal pastor and showing that the kind of practical, loving, sensitive ministry that Benedict had. Benedict was born in around 480 A.D. He was a son of a wealthy Roman family, and this was a very tumultuous time in the Roman Empire. He went to a classic Roman school and didn't fit in with all of this pagan environment around him, and so he decided that he was going to try to live a life that was countercultural, very, very focused on God, and he moved out into the desert to dedicate his life to prayer and to seeking God. Now, he attracted so many people out to that desert that they began to ask him if he would come and be a leader of a monastery with them. So he tried that, and the monks almost murdered him because they didn't want to live according to his discipline. So he went out into the desert again, but he had such a reputation for holiness that people still kept going out there to listen to his wisdom and to talk to him and to learn from him. So finally he decided, okay, this was what God was calling for him to do. So he left the desert, and he built 13 monasteries, one of which he was the leader of, and he mentored those monks, and he wrote his rule for that monastery and those monasteries that he was in charge of. And that's the rule that ended up becoming such an influential force in monasticism after him.
Can you give us the basic elements of Benedict's rule?
Mm-hmm. Well, in our issue, the author, Hugh Feiss, who wrote this rule, who's a Benedictine monk himself, he calls this rule, he says that Benedict's central conviction is that prayerful listening should be the center of the Christian life, It's that emphasis on listening. So the first word of the rule is listen. And the whole structure of a monk's day, as it's set forth in Benedict's rule, is centered around prayer and listening to God. So Benedict had eight times during the day when the monks came together for a communal prayer. This is called the Divine Office. There were other times during the day when they would dedicate their time to reading and study, other times when they would be working. So it was a balanced life of prayer and reading or study of the Bible and work. And in all of this, the monks were to be developing a character of humility, the character of a disciple who's listening and learning, and who is whose prayer overflows into good works, into love towards his fellow monks, and outward into the community in serving the poor, in ministering to people who came to the hospitality, who were needy. They were also to listen to each other. This was a community. This is not somebody going off into the desert by themselves. This is a community. Each had a job to do. And Benedict is very careful and very practical in how he sets forth how that community life is to be. Everyone is supposed to have enough food and enough sleep. Everything is held in common. Everyone has a specific task. Everyone must treat pilgrims and the poor and guests as if they were Christ himself. And they were to listen to the abbot as the one who is shepherding them. And the abbot is to listen to the rest of the community. So we call this article The Life of Listening, because this is really the center point of Benedict's blueprint for how a Christian life and community that's dedicated to living out one's spirituality in a very intense and focused way, how this is best done.
It's interesting because the reputation that monasticism has gained, largely through perhaps fictional accounts of things like this or movies, is of some extremity.
Yes.
Whereas Benedict's rule, rather than having the people who were dedicated to his rule praying for hours on end, he said prayer should be short.
Yes.
He didn't believe in any extravagance in these areas, did he?
And this is something that really set Benedict apart from some before him who had also written rules. He based his rule on other rules, but his rule was seen by people after him as very balanced, very humane, very practical. He really understood human nature and the temptations that monks face, the downfalls, the limitations of individual people. Just to take one example, earlier monastic rules sometimes would prohibit wine. But Benedict knew that people are different, people have different limitations. And so in his rule he says, let's at least agree to drink sparingly. So he didn't prohibit it. He allowed for individual differences, and he created a rule that was flexible and that understood the differences among people. And that's one of the reasons why his rule was so adaptable to so many situations, and that's why the rule endured for so long.
Initially, any thoughts on why communal monastic, often celibate and ascetic living was so very popular? It's not as though people were being forced into this lifestyle. People were sometimes flocking to it in droves.
Yes, and you know, in the earliest church, how did you show your devotion to God? What was the ultimate test? It was martyrdom. This was a culture in which the church was a persecuted minority, and the way that you showed that you were absolutely devoted to God to the end was to go to death over your faith. Well, then the Roman Empire, Constantine became a Christian. The Roman Empire was not any longer persecuting the Christians. So instead of having that ultimate test being, being willing to go to the lions for your faith, many Christians were trying to live out a very radical, countercultural way of living the Christian faith by this monastic way of life. That was their way of really showing that against all the values of the pagan culture around them, they were absolutely, fundamentally devoted to God.
We're talking with Jennifer Trafton, managing editor of Christian History and Biography magazine. about 5th, 6th century Western monastic Benedict, and that's the theme of the latest issue of Christian History and Biography magazine. Our call-in numbers as we come to you live this Monday, March the 19th, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Perhaps, Jennifer, we can discern some providence in the rise of monasticism, because by the time we get to the tumultuous Middle Ages and then, of course, the period of long plague and wars that followed afterwards, mm-hmm. it is the monasteries that preserve Western civilization.
In many ways, yes. It's kind of counterintuitive. You think of monks as being those who separate themselves off from the world, and kind of that's the typical stereotype. These are people that just want to be over there by themselves in a monastery and have nothing to do with the rest of the world. But actually, by creating that stable community, they had a profound influence on the culture around them. It was monks who were among the chief agents of missions in Europe. As Europe went from being mostly a pagan continent, with Christianity being mainly in the cities of the old Roman Empire, to about the 9th century, it had spread. Christianity had spread all over Central and Northern Europe, and monks were at the center of that missionary spread. And then later on, after Europe began to really disintegrate, Charlemagne's empire really began to fall apart, it was the monasteries who were really preserving the literature, the books. They were the points of stability and peace amidst that turmoil.
So these were not just places of worship and prayer. There were also places of learning.
Yes, especially under Charlemagne. When Charlemagne, the king of the Franks, extended his rule over a very large territory of Western Europe, he was very committed to trying to unify Europe and to bring order and reform to the church that was really kind of a mess at that point in time. And the monasteries played a vital role in that. The monks learned to read Latin. They became the publishing houses of their day. They developed a way of writing known as Carolingian minuscule, which is, if you look at it, you can recognize them as the letter shapes that we still have today. And they, through all of their endless copying and copying of manuscripts, they preserved ancient literature. A lot of the oldest surviving copies of classical works we have today were made by, or were copied by, Benedictine monks in the early Middle Ages. They were also commercial centers, industrial centers. They were they had fleets and wharves. Some of the wealthiest monasteries did. They were centers of agricultural activity and welfare and medical caregiving and travel. So they were really they were absolutely central to European culture in that Middle Ages.
You did an article along with Thomas Kay
mm-hmm.
on. And this is just, you have to see the pictures, and it's a shame that listeners can't see these.
Mm-hmm.
Marvelous manuscripts.
Yes.
That were, why were they illuminating these manuscripts to such a degree? Pictures that are remarkably beautiful, and sometimes entire precious pages of these books mm-hmm. are devoted to illustration rather than to the text.
And this has been a tradition in Christianity going back even before this period, these books are considered precious objects. This was long before the printing press. This is long before books just become something we can buy for a couple bucks at the local store. Books took many, many years to create. They were often the possession of royalty or of large monasteries. They were precious objects. And so they did spend a lot of time and a lot of energy and artistic energy making these books as beautiful as they could. And they really are magnificent.
Let's talk a bit about the modern legacy of Pope Benedict.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of Benedict. Where would you place your finger to highlight his greatest legacy today?
Well, I think that the thousands and thousands of monasteries that still exist today are the obvious place where you can see his legacy. This is not something that died out through all of the changes that Western culture has gone through. We still have Benedictine monks and nuns who are looking back to this 5th century monk and his rule as the one who set the standard for the kind of life that they're called to live. And so this is still a tradition that's alive and well and having a lot of impact. What's interesting and what we really learned in making this issue is that you can see this legacy in other places as well today. I already mentioned the thousands of oblates and monastic associates, lay people, Protestants and Catholics who are not becoming monks and nuns, but who are making certain commitments to spiritual disciplines and to a particular monastic community. And, you know, and finding in that lifestyle something that they seem to be lacking in the everyday world. This is becoming more and more of a popular thing. Also, in the Catholic Church, there are many ecclesial communities, which are not monastic, but, again, another growing phenomenon. And Dennis Martin, who's our consultant for this issue, a scholar of medieval Christianity, sees these as meeting needs that in the past could only have been met by somebody joining a monastery. But today, that lay people can be devoting their lives to a more focused kind of spirituality in other ways. In Protestant circles, it's very interesting that you see a new movement called New Monasticism growing. These are intentional communities that are intended to be countercultural. They're communal. Often they are dedicated to things like serving the poor, racial reconciliation, certain spiritual disciplines. So again and again, you see in many ways people looking back to Benedict and to this monastic tradition to try to find ways of bringing a spiritual focus, a sense of community, a connectedness to their lives in the modern world.
Interesting quote at the beginning of one of the articles by Chris Armstrong, in the latest issue of Christian History and Biography, from evangelical Mark Knoll. It's very telling when he says, for over a millennium in the centuries between the reign of Constantine and Protestant Reformation, almost everything in the church that approached the highest, noblest, and truest ideals of the gospel was done either by those who had chosen the monastic way or by those who had been inspired in their Christian life by the monks. What's Knoll saying there?
Well, he's making a very provocative statement there, that in all of those centuries of the church, when you look at the people who've really impacted the church, so often they were monastics or they were somehow influenced. Just think of Francis of Assisi. Everyone knows who Francis of Assisi is today. He's still having an impact on people. People are still inspired by Francis. He was not a monk. He was not a Benedictine. But Francis and others like him were a later stage of that same impulse, of taking that impulse out into the streets. So I think Mark is making a very provocative statement about the fact that, you know, if you look back at history, you can't take monasticism out of the picture and still have the Europe that we know and the Christianity that we know.
Luther was quite critical of monasticism in his day, and his primary criticism came from what he referred to as self-invented works, that it was often misinterpreted, as a former monk himself, is often misinterpreted as a means by which someone ascends to God by doing extraordinary deeds above and beyond the call of duty for the ordinary Christian. But at least in Benedict's case, did he envision a Christian life according to his rule that was anything other than what the ordinary Christian was called to do?
Well, monasticism was never meant to be something that was completely different from what the ordinary Christian did. What it was intended to do is to provide a space for Christians to carry out that Christian life in a more focused, intense way. So it was like the normal Christian life intensified. And Luther and the reformers were, in a large part, reacting against a lot of the abuses that came in the later Middle Ages to monasticism, of people, who were not living with the purity and the dedication that they should have, who were making it into a works righteousness. But even Calvin did look back and praise the earliest monks for their devotion to God. And it really, you know, theologically, it depends on how you interpret. But, you know, I think a Benedictine would say, look, this is not a way to earn salvation. These are ways to serve the Lord.
For more information on Christian History and Biography magazine, you can go to the link section of our website. It's issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, and look for Jennifer Trafton and Christian History and Biography magazine right under the link section, issuesetc.org. Jennifer is managing editor of Christian History and Biography, and the theme of the latest issue is Benedict and the Rise of Western Monasticism. Jennifer, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, Luther was right to criticize monasticism for its abuse, especially when it came to what he would have called those self-invented works that came in their abuse to substitute for the all-sufficient works of Christ. He was right to criticize it. Notice the things that Luther does not criticize. He does not criticize endeavoring toward a life of prayer or of study. Luther continued to do those things after he left the Augustinian monastery. To the great benefit of us all, by the way, a life of prayer and study. He did not eschew the monastic love for the neighbor or seeking to serve the community, especially those who were helpless and without hope in the community. No, that was retained as well. It is always in the abuse. It is always in the abuse where the warning needs to be sounded. And if people's efforts toward modern-day monasticism are simply efforts toward self-actualization, self-improvement, then that's as ridiculous as self-invented works. Or if they're trying to cloister themselves away from the world and escape into a theological never-never land, there again is an abuse. However, if this is a genuine love for God's word, dedication to a life of prayer and study that does not forsake your neighbor and his needs, if it does not substitute your works for Christ's and does not elevate this life that one chooses, a rule or a discipline that one chooses above that of the gifts that God gives to every Christian, if it does not obscure the gospel, the perfect life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ and the forgiveness of sins that is for all through his all-sufficient life, his all-sufficient work, then it is something to be commended. When we come back from this break, we've got hour three of Issues Etc. ahead. Very interesting. I won't call this monasticism, although it's hard not to draw some parallels between a move that is afoot to man up Jesus, to inject a little testosterone back into the church. Maybe an example, as we'll hear from ABC News Nightline, of diagnosing the symptoms rightly, but only treating the symptoms and leaving the root problem untreated. We've got audio open lines on the other side of this break. I want to hear from you after we listen to an ABC News Nightline feature titled Searching for a Manly Jesus. By the way, it features a regular guest to this program, Paul Coughlin, written the book No More Christian Nice Guys. And we'll find out about this movement and get your reaction to it on the other side of this break. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Tomorrow on the program, we'll talk about hospice with Pastor Mark Sell.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues Etc.